Welcome to the Willie Jackerson Experiment. I'm your host, the one, the only, Willie Jackerson. So, I got a special show for you this week. I decided to do OJ, and it was kind of a thing that I kind of do on all these podcasts is I'll try to kind of go into them blind and not really know much, but I did go through and look for some audio and kind of go back into the whole trial again, and you know, it was quite a bit of evidence, you know, linking him to the murders, you know, and he was acquitted, and they basically called it like a setup and stuff. So you know, I feel, you know, he probably did get away with murder, and you know, he wrote a book, which, you know, some of the stuff looking back into the audio is kind of interesting. He wrote a book, If I Did It, and then I guess the you know, Nicole Brown's family and the Goldman's family went and took the book, and then they changed it to, it still says If I Did It, but they put If really small in there, so it just basically says I did it, it looks like it on the book. So it's pretty funny. I didn't realize that. There was a lot of new little things I learned, and he was an amazing athlete, you know, probably the best running back of the 70s, arguably one of the top running backs of all time, you know, which kind of amazed me. You know, like I said, I wasn't even, you know, I wasn't even born when he went and hit 1,000 yards. So that was pretty awesome. And so there was some things I learned on this episode I think you'll find interesting. And of course, I try to find some OJ Simpson metal. So we'll see. I was trying to find some cool audio and some funny things to kind of look back on and kind of make light of it. So I really appreciate everyone joining every week. I've received so many awesome reviews that just means a lot. And I've just really been happy doing these every week. It's just so much fun. It's a lot of fun putting together. And like I say, I always try to do new different things. So I really appreciate it. And make sure that you check out some of my other episodes. And I'm trying to put in polls and questions and stuff like that, so that I could kind of interact with everyone out there. So I really appreciate it. Got a lot of love every week. And remember, make every day an easy day. See y'all next week. Peace.
For then, judging on, and no one's gonna give in. Living on your knees, conformity. For dying
on your feet,
for us eating bread.
Our bodies
work as one. Bloody, but never crush a mission. Following
our instinct, not a trend. Go against the grain.
Until the end,
blood
will
follow flow.
Blood. Die.
In
time this year.
Damage Incorporated.
Should I put it on? I like this better. You can have my jacket too.
We chew
and spit you
out.
We
laugh, you scream
and shout.
Only
with fear,
run! You know just where we come from.
Damage Incorporated.
Yeah!
Nowadays, when you hear the name O.J. Simpson, there is just no way that you think of the football player who dominated the running back position in the early 1970s. And if you haven't been asleep for the last 30 or so years, you would know that O.J. Simpson went to trial for the double murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman. And everything surrounding this trial, including O.J. not showing up to court and going on a low-speed chase in the white Ford Bronco, as well as the eventual trial, where O.J. was ruled not guilty on both counts of murder, became some of the most iconic pop culture moments in American history, and for all the wrong reasons. And O.J. did end up going to prison for a robbery that took place in late 2007, but many people who are not old enough to remember the O.J. Simpson trial mistakenly think that this prison time had anything to do with the murder trial, but it actually did not at all. And finally, on June 20th, 2017, O.J. Simpson was granted release with parole and was released from parole in December 2021 for good behavior. That the NFL Hall of Fame felt that they could not tell the story of the National Football League's history without including O.J. Simpson.
If you start a conversation about O.J. Simpson and you begin by talking about what a great tailback he was, initially people are confused and then they get mad. I mean, it's just so weird now because even talking about him as a football player, it seems like you're missing, like we're overlooking the obvious. O.J.'s football legacy is destroyed. People will never remember or think about what a great running back he was because of the last half of his life, and there's no way around it. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure that out. In his obituary, football player now is mentioned in the first paragraph, but they don't talk about USC or the Bills until paragraph 5. I think people have completely overlooked the fact now that he was clearly the best running back of the 70s. So if you sort of realize that he's the best running back at a time when the most important part of the offensive game is running the football, I think you could easily argue that O.J. Simpson is the most valuable player of the 70s for the entire league. Every time he ran the ball, it was almost like the Bills' equivalent of throwing the ball deep. It might not work, but if you made a mistake, they would score.
You know, when you're fresh in the game, early in the game, you got a lot on your mind. You're thinking of the game plans, you're thinking of things that you saw, because you've been watching it on film all week. As the game goes on, you get tired, and you stop thinking so much, and you start reacting. It's like putting things in that computer. You just push a button, you get the ball, and you go.
I've seen footage of O.J. Simpson running the football dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and I can't, for the life of me, even remember the number of the guy handing him the ball. He had no element of surprise. He had no passing game to sort of change the way defensive played him, and he was incredibly effective. He was not going to play in a Super Bowl. There was no shot. So he has this game on Thanksgiving where he rushes for 273 yards. Proof that the best football player in the world is just sort of being wasted on this team going no place.
On Thanksgiving 1976, Buffalo's quarterback completed 4 of 21 passes for 29 yards. O.J. Simpson ran 29 times for a then single game record 273 yards in defeat. Playoffs eluded Simpson in 10 of his 11 seasons. Jim Brown's single-season rushing record did not. In 1973, playing a 14-game season, Simpson sprinted for a staggering 2,003 yards.
Gaining 2,003 yards in a 14-game schedule is substantially more impressive than Eric Dickerson's best season, or Barry Sanders' best season, or Terrell Davis's best season.
OJ running left, OJ 5-4, there it is, he did it, he did it. Yeah. I just wonder if the three of us at this moment fully realize what it has been our great privilege to watch OJ Simpson run for 2,000 yards.
Beyond seeing what he's tangibly doing, there's then that intangible quality of what would happen if he played for the Steelers? Or what if he was on the Raiders? How many yards would he run for? That actually kind of lifts his greatness.
And so on this 15th day of what is considered to be the most important trial of the day, Johnny Cochran has appeared to defend Capitalist Records. The question now is, will Cochran use his famous Chewbacca defense?
What's a Chewbacca defense?
I don't know.
That's what Cochran used in the O.J. Simpson trial. God damn, I hate that Cochran guy. If he was here in front of me, I'd be like, hey, you stupid son of a bitch. I'm going to kick you in the nuts.
I'm sure that would scare the hell out of him, Cartman.
And so, in summation, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard the version of my client's song recorded over 20 years ago. You've heard the exact same song produced by these cheats in the past month. I'd say it's pretty much an open and shut case. Make the right decision. Thank you. We've got him.
Mr. Johnny Cochran, your closing arguments.
Ladies and gentlemen of the supposed jury, Chef's attorney would certainly want you to believe that his client wrote Stinky Britches 10 years ago. And they make a good case. Hell, I almost felt pity myself. But ladies and gentlemen of this supposed jury, I have one final thing I want you to consider. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Chewbacca. Chewbacca is a Wookiee from the planet Kishik, but Chewbacca lives on the planet Endor. Now think about that. That does not make sense.
Damn it.
What?
He's using the Chewbacca defense.
Why would a Wookiee, an 8-foot-tall Wookiee, want to live on Endor with a bunch of 2-foot-tall Ewoks? That does not make sense. But more importantly, you have to ask yourself, what does this have to do with this case? Nothing. Ladies and gentlemen, it has nothing to do with this case. It does not make sense. Look at me. I'm a lawyer defending a major record company, and I'm talking about Chewbacca. Does that make sense? Ladies and gentlemen, I am not making any sense. None of this makes sense. And so you have to remember, when you're in that jury room deliberating and conjugating the Emancipation Proclamation, does it make sense? No. Ladies and gentlemen of this supposed jury, it does not make sense. If Chewbacca lives on Endor, you must acquit. The defense rests.
Okay, then.
Wow, he's good.
In a teary-eyed courtroom, Johnny Cochran has just finished his closing arguments, and as was anticipated, he did use the Chewbacca defense. Whether or not it worked is up to the jury to decide.
How find you the jury?
We find the defendant, Jerome Chef McElroy, guilty as charged.
Whoops!
Whoops!
Mr. Chef, you've been found guilty of harassing a major record label. The full fee of $2 million will be handed over within 24 hours.
Do I look like I have $2 million?
Well, you have 24 hours to find it, or else you'll have to go to jail for 8 million years.
It's actually for 4 years.
Oh, sorry. You'll go to jail for 4 years.
This can't be happening.
Oh, no, dude. Chef's gonna go to jail.
Eleven years after a jury found him not guilty of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, O.J. Simpson wrote a book, and he called it, I Did It. Here's the story behind this book. Although acquitted on criminal charges, O.J. was later found financially liable, so he has always owed money to the families of the victims. In 2006, to make some money, he decided to write, If I Did It. The premise of the book was literally O.J. saying, I didn't do it, but if I did, here's how and why I would have. As you can imagine, the public was revolted by that idea, and all 400,000 copies of the book that had been made were destroyed. But a year later, a bankruptcy court said, hey look, OJ still owes these families money, let's give them this asset. And so, the Goldman family took the book and published it. Now, they have always believed in OJ's guilt, and so they made the cover look like this, I Did It. But they're not libeling him, the title is still technically, If I Did It. If I did it.
As a kid growing up in the ghetto, one of the things I wanted the most was not money, it was fame. I wanted to be known. I wanted people to say, hey, there goes OJ. That wish came true for Mr. Orenthal James Simpson, one of the greatest American athletes that ever lived, and a man who was the accused in one of the grisliest and most controversial murder cases ever to paint TV screens all around the world. Was he guilty? Did he get away with murder? Was he an egomaniac harboring a dangerous personality disorder? Or was he the friendly, jovial giant he came across as in the public eye? The victim of a conspiracy, not the type of guy who would almost hack off the head of the one he professed to love. Before we get into that, some of you might not be familiar with this once American idol, sports icon, and man that divided America. So let's introduce you to him. He's best known as O.J. Simpson. But to many back in the day, he was known as the Juice. Brought up on the wrong side of town to an adoring mother and a drag queen father, OJ got into trouble as a kid and also suffered from physical disabilities due to having had rickets. But what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and this rather large boy started to focus his efforts on sports. This is a crime story, not a sports bio. So to cut a long story short, we can say that OJ soon became an excellent American football player. So good, in fact, that he became one of the best college football players in history. His forte was running, dodging, crashing through, and gliding by players as if they were cardboard cutouts. He was destined for a very successful pro career. That got off to a rocky start, but then OJ the Invincible became the first pro player to rush more than 2,000 yards in a season. The year was 1973, and OJ was just 26. He was a sensation, and it can't be understated just how much he became a hero, not only to the African-American community, but to all athletes and armchair aficionados of sports. Other players would breach 2,000 yards in the future, but only OJ did it in a 14-game season. The others did it in 16 games. His stardom put his face on TV for more than just sports, with perhaps his liftoff to celebrity status being a Hertz car rental commercial featuring him running through an airport. The other cast of characters would smile and watch him run by, saying, "Go OJ!" He was the American dream come true, the black guy from the wrong side of the tracks, showing everyone that anyone could make it in America. Critics have since said he was used in a way to obfuscate the pervasive racism in America at the time, and his rags-to-riches tale was far from accessible to most poor black Americans. But others hailed his role model status as a veritable U.S. success story. OJ soon became embedded in a predominantly white upper-class society. In interviews, some of his former friends have said this was problematic, that OJ abandoned his roots, that he was merely a token black dude for people who cared little about him. OJ said he never thought about color or race and just did what he did. He settled down and got married, and with his first wife had three children. One of those would die young from drowning. At the same time OJ was acting in Hollywood blockbusters, his dreams had come true. People really were saying, "Hey, there goes OJ." We must say at this point his celebrity didn't encircle the globe, as American football wasn't very popular outside of the US. But give him a few years and OJ would be a household name from Adelaide to Aberdeen, for all the wrong reasons. In 1979, he met an 18-year-old girl called Nicole Brown, who was a waitress in a private Beverly Hills club called Daisy. He told one of his friends that one day he would marry this incredibly beautiful girl, and the unstoppable OJ did just that after he had divorced his first wife. The year was 1985 when OJ married Brown, and the two would have two children of their own shortly after the marriage. This was a rocky relationship, and in interviews, Brown's friends have come forward a number of times to say he was a man with a violent temper. In fact, in 1989, OJ pleaded no contest to spousal abuse. The two later divorced in 1992. You can actually listen to a recording of Brown calling the police at one point, saying she was scared he was going to beat her badly. The domestic violence that OJ perpetrated had not been denied, not even by most of his fans. But was the juice capable of brutally murdering people? Let's now take you to the crime scene. The night of the crime was June 12, 1994. We might never know exactly what happened on that night, but Brown and her friend Ron Goldman were found dead at Brown's townhouse in Brentwood, Los Angeles. If you've seen the documentaries about this crime, you might have seen the crime scene photos. Brown had been hit on the head with a blunt object, slashed multiple times, and stabbed. It was likely she was already dead when the murderer slit her throat so viciously he or she almost decapitated her. Goldman, it seems, had struggled with the murderer for some time, but having run into a place surrounded by bars, he had no way out. He was slashed and stabbed multiple times too. It seems one of his major arteries in his leg was cut and he lost a lot of blood quickly. But as one commentator said, the murderer again went into overkill. Goldman was stabbed in the neck at almost the same place multiple times. No one disagreed. Whoever had done this had done so fueled by a monstrous rage. It's said that Goldman had been at Brown's house as he was delivering some lost glasses. He had put those in an envelope. Both the glasses and the envelope were later found at the crime scene. We'll later hear in court that a loud bang was heard at her house in the evening. Simpson had never had a solid alibi, but has stated that he was home during the time of the murders, approximately 10:15 p.m. But we'll come back to that later. The first officers on the scene witnessed the carnage, noticing a bloody glove also just lying around. One detective, Mark Furman, then went around to OJ's house, fearing he might also be one of the victims, and if not, to tell OJ what happened at his former wife's house. OJ's house and Brown's place were only a matter of minutes away by car, and it's well known to police about OJ and Brown's marriage and divorce. At OJ's house, another bloody glove was found, and it matched the glove found at Brown's house. More blood was seen leading from Simpson's parked car. It was later discovered that the victim's blood was on both gloves, which gave police probable cause to arrest Simpson. The thing was, Simpson had flown to Chicago on the night of the murders. He'd also been taken to the airport by a Mr. Park in his limousine. It's thought that this happened sometime after the murders probably happened. Mr. Park would testify that when he was to pick Simpson up, his white Ford Bronco was not parked in the street. Simpson seemed to be out, and so he drove around waiting. Mr. Park would testify that it wasn't until 10:56 p.m. that he would see a large, strong-looking African-American man walk into Simpson's house. He went to the door, and OJ finally appeared, saying he was sorry he was late. Off they went to the airport. So police are looking for Simpson, and they would get their chance to talk to him. After being told about the murder, Simpson flies back to LA. Police now have a search warrant for Simpson's house, and more blood is found. When OJ gets home, he's handcuffed and questioned for over 3 hours. The line of questioning has since been criticized. Cops go easy on him. A few days later, and he goes to the funeral of his ex-wife. And a day after that, he's charged with 2 counts of murder. He's asked to surrender, but he doesn't give himself up. Instead, what happens is one of the biggest media moments of the late 20th century, as Simpson is followed by helicopters and a stream of police cars down the highway. It's what's called a media circus. It has America and most of the world glued to their TV screens. It's reported that he has a gun and he might kill himself. People all over America believe this has been a setup. They shout, "Go OJ!" The cars following make it look more like a president's motorcade than a police chase. This will become one of the most iconic moments in news history. Massive crowds are waiting on highway bridges, standing in the streets, holding signs that read "Free OJ." They're chanting, "OJ, OJ, OJ." It's as if the juice is back on the field on one of his epic runs, and the world doesn't want him to stop. His car finally arrives at his house. SWAT teams are out. People are running around. Helicopters overhead. It's chaos. OJ waits in his car. His gun is said to be close to his chin. If he steps out with the gun in his hand, he will most likely be shot. He doesn't want to do that and is talked out of the car. The negotiator years later will say that while in OJ's house, he noticed only pictures, paintings, photos of the star. None of anyone else, not even the family. And so to lure him out of the car, he appealed to OJ's ego, his greatness. It worked. People interviewed in the streets are saying it's a conspiracy, more oppression and human rights abuses by a police force known to be corrupt, sometimes racist, sometimes unnecessarily violent. The case of Rodney King still stings among the African-American community, who for good reason have doubts about the ethics of the LAPD. The police are well aware of the tension and the destruction of the LA riots of 92. They move as if tenterhooks. Other men may have perhaps been treated with less trepidation. A court date is made. The prosecutors later said to the media, "I don't think I'd ever seen so much evidence in one case." It didn't look cut and dried, but to OJ's fans, something was rotten in the state of California. If anyone could find where that stink was coming from, it was the civil rights lawyer John Cochran. He was a hero to many people in the African-American community. Already, some people had forgotten about the 2 hacked bodies and were concentrating their emotions on a race case. Cochran had done commendable work over the years and had fought for the downtrodden, and OJ had the money to hire him, as well as a bevy of other top lawyers. "Boy, I was set up," OJ would soon say. And his words echoed throughout black communities over the USA. Surveys showed that only 10% of African Americans in the US thought he was guilty. The final jury, many of them black Americans, were also later said to have been somewhat blinded or moved by the race issue. OJ even said to his lawyer, joking, "If this jury says I did it, maybe I did do it." It wasn't cheap though, the trial. It said OJ would make around $3 million just by signing items with autographs as he sat in jail. He was still adored by many, regardless of what he might have done. It was the trial of the century, and within a trial was another kind of trial. That's because the policemen that found the glove at OJ's house would be found to have said some very racist things in the past. On top of that, it was also found, with good evidence, that he had bragged about police brutality. The case became as much about this bad cop as it did the murders. Yet again, another giant fail for the LAPD. "The glove must have been planted by him," shouted OJ fans. "It's just another case of police racism." There was blood of the victims all over the place, from OJ's house to his car. It was open and shut in terms of DNA evidence. But those crafty lawyers proved that the crime scene had been contaminated and that possibly there had been a setup. They weren't trying to prove that the cops had something against OJ, only that the possibility that they had planted evidence for an easier arrest. Even though OJ had been cut himself that night and his blood was mixed with the victim's, the lawyers managed to convince a jury that something was wrong. And indeed, the police had mishandled evidence. We might also say that DNA evidence was kind of new to everyone, not just the jury. Nowadays, we can read things such as this. It is reported that the DNA evidence showed that the chance that some of the blood found near the bodies came from anyone but Simpson was 1 in 170 million. The chance that the blood found on Simpson's sock could be from someone other than Nicole Brown was 1 in 21 billion. But back then, the jurors didn't trust DNA. They also believed the defense in that there had been some kind of setup and OJ's blood had been taken and just thrown everywhere, from the crime scene to his car, to his house, to his clothes. The gloves were tried on in court, and famously, OJ donned latex gloves first, and then somewhat dramatically proved his hands were too big for the leather ones. Another bad move from the prosecution. His blood and the victim's were on those gloves, but it didn't matter. As Cochran told the jury, if the glove doesn't fit, acquit. Hair from an African American was also found at the scene, and on Ron Goldman's shirt, while shoes matching Simpson's size had made footprints in the blood. After the trial, evidence would be found of Simpson owning the exact shoes that were worn by the killer. But it was too late then. The sock we just mentioned was also found at Simpson's home, and that too had blood of the victims on it. But as we said, some finagling by very clever lawyers persuaded the jury not that the cops had colluded and set OJ up, but that there was a chance that evidence had been mishandled. Photos of Brown's bruised face were shown to the jury. From a time Simpson had beat her in the past and been arrested, it didn't matter. There was a racist cop involved with that evidence, and that meant something. LAPD criminalists had done a poor job, and that meant something too. Cochran orated a summation fitting of a wartime speech, and even though it was completely over the top by many people's standards, it meant something as well. So even with so much evidence, the case of the prosecution was doomed. And as one of the former jurors said in a documentary interview, she was never going to find him guilty. This was payback for Rodney King. She said 90% of the other juries thought the same, although in the same documentary, another former juror said she had no bones about King relating to this case. But the prosecution had pretty much failed and let a guilty man go free. Lots of evidence was not presented by the defense, such as Brown calling a woman's shelter days before her death, saying she feared her ex-husband was stalking her, or the fact that a shop owner had said Simpson had bought a 15-inch knife from him that might have matched the kind of knife in the murders. The prosecution couldn't use that because the man who sold it to Simpson sold his story to the media. Police did search for a knife but couldn't find one. The media also reports that a knife was found during the demolition of Simpson's house some years later, but it was kept as a memento by an LAPD officer. Another person said she saw Simpson's Ford Bronco driving wildly that night, but she also sold that story to the media, and so the prosecution couldn't use her testimony. Civil rights activists called it a victory for Black America, and no shortage of people jubilantly shouted from the streets that justice had been served. What most people failed to realize is that OJ had admitted that he would have lost without doubt had he not have had this expensive team of lawyers. In terms of human rights, was this justice not justice bought with money? Did the color of the money hold more sway than the color of the skin? No one seemed to ask. Black, white, or brown, if you're poor, you're having a harder time in court than if you're rich. Had justice really prevailed, it was hard to call it a victory, and in this case might have meant two people being slaughtered like cattle by a man who thought he was untouchable. Simpson did lose a civil case to Ron Goldman's family, and a jury found OJ guilty of causing wrongful death. This meant that Simpson was ordered in total to pay both families of the deceased $33.5 million in compensatory and punitive damages. But how much they got was nothing close to that. They hounded Simpson for years, or at least the Goldmans did, but OJ had a way of protecting what little money he had left. OJ did end up going to prison after a few years of acting like a gangster and making music videos and some TV shows. He was apparently trying to get some of his memorabilia back, but a failed hotel heist in Las Vegas got him 9 years. He was released in 2017, and it's said he now lives a quiet life as a retiree somewhere in Las Vegas. Apparently, he still loves golf, but we might imagine his juice glass these days is half empty. His former manager is now reportedly making a new documentary. He has stated that Simpson did the murders but did not act alone. There's also a very strange television interview that's come to light, in which Simpson gives a hypothetical version of events on the night of the murders. What's strange is that Simpson basically retraces the steps of himself that night and how he hypothetically commits the murders. He says this in a third person, such as, he took the Bronco to her home with his friend, brought a knife, and put on a hat and gloves for dramatic effect. He even added, it was horrible, it was absolutely horrible. Simpson then says Goldman tried some karate move with him and he asked him if he thought he could kick his backside. He said he then blacked out, but came around and there was stuff all around them. He was talking about blood. If you watch this, you might just wonder what the heck you've just seen. The video was not published for many years because it was such a sensitive case and there could be legal issues, so the tapes were reportedly only recently found. So after hearing all this, are you in the Go OJ camp or do you think he was guilty? What do you think about him, the investigation, his diehard fans? Tell us in the comments. Also, be sure to check out our other video, America's Most Evil Serial Killer, Ted Bundy. Thanks for watching, and as always, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. See you next time.
Hey, man, are you ready?
Yeah, man, but you look stupid.
Man of constant sorrow, take one. In constant sorrow.
No great loss? Here's what the family of the late Ron Goldman has to say about O.J. Simpson's death. Clearly, there's no love lost. Following the April 10th, 2024 death of O.J. Simpson from cancer, Fred Goldman broke his silence. The father of the late Ron Goldman, who was murdered alongside Simpson's ex-wife Nicole Brown in 1994, didn't hold back when talking about the man he believes was responsible for his son's tragic death. Speaking of Simpson's death, he told NBC News in a phone call, "The only thing I have to say is, it's just a further reminder of Ron being gone all these years. It's no great loss to the world." Simpson, who was a famed former NFL player and Hollywood celebrity at the time, quickly became the prime suspect in the double murder case. Notably, he and Brown had separated 2 years prior after a tumultuous 7-year marriage marred by domestic violence. Despite their divorce in 1992, Simpson was reportedly continuously possessive of Brown. According to people close to Ron, he and Brown were just friends, the Los Angeles Times reported. At the time of their deaths, Ron was 25, while Brown was 35 years old. When O.J. Simpson was charged in 1994, rather than surrendering, he attempted to evade arrest by sending the police on a car chase, hiding in the back of a car driven by a friend. Known as the Bronco Chase, the incident didn't help Simpson, as he was ultimately captured and brought to trial. Famously dubbed the Trial of the Century, O.J. Simpson's court case was heavily televised. Despite significant evidence against Simpson, including DNA evidence at the murder scene, circumstantial evidence, and suspicious behavior on the night of the murders, he was found not guilty.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder.
It was widely believed that the jury's decision to let Simpson walk free was influenced by racial tensions, as systemic racism was a significant issue between African Americans and the LAPD in the early 1990s. Following Simpson's acquittal, Fred Goldman claimed that Simpson's lawyers employed racial tactics to sway the criminal jury away from incriminating evidence, according to CNN.
Justice was not served.
Following the criminal trial, the Goldman and Brown families pursued a civil judgment against Simpson. The civil jury found Simpson liable for both murders, awarding the families $33.5 million in compensatory damages. During an appearance on Good Morning America in 2017, Goldman said the victory was a small step in the right direction. Despite prevailing in the civil case against O.J. Simpson, the families of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman have yet to receive full compensation for the awarded amount. Attorney David Cook revealed that Simpson's failure to pay has resulted in the growing to over $100 million, according to the Daily Mail. Even after his death, Simpson's heirs could be impacted by the outstanding settlement, as the Goldmans have pledged to pursue Simpson's real estate as well as his children's assets. Notably, Fred Goldman, along with his daughter Kim, released a longer statement to the media following Simpson's death. The Goldmans said, "The news of Ron's killer passing away is a mixed bag of complicated emotions and reminds us that the journey through grief is not linear. For 3 decades, we tirelessly pursued justice for Ron and Nicole, and despite a civil judgment and his confession in If I Did It, the hope for true accountability has ended."
He did a horrible, heinous crime, and I have no feeling except rotten hell.
In 1997, the family authored a book titled His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice, wherein Fred openly conveyed his hatred towards Simpson, writing, "I believe this world would be a better place without you. There is nothing more to say."